Wicked problems. Isn't that a great term? It's actually used to describe these complex, hard to define problems. Things that are hard to figure out, never mind figure out how to tackle. Things that we're trying to deal with here. They include things like plastic pollution in our waterways, rising sea levels related to climate change, the effects of colonization, and toxins in the food chain. These are all wicked problems. You've likely been reading about or pondering how to address a wicked problem in your life. It would be something like why your local government isn't taking more action on climate change, or maybe how to reduce food waste in grocery stores, or how to turn your workplace into one that values the environment. But there are useful and practical approaches that actually work on wicked problems. Before we get into it, though, I want to remind you that I am on a mission to help professional women who are deeply concerned about environmental and social issues, who want to find ways to take action that lights them up so that they can create meaningful change in the world. If that sounds like you, head over to my website. It's ChristinaHunterFlourishing.com. That's Christina with a K. And hit the Let's Chat button to set up a call with me. Okay, let's dive in. I am Christina Hunter, and you are listening to the Live Well Green podcast, all about empowering you to create a more sustainable, equitable world. I taught environmental sustainability at the post-secondary level for 20 years, and yet I still felt that I was not doing enough. So I stepped back and began to focus on the big picture in order to find the key activities that actually make a difference and how to accomplish them without burning yourself out. Here, I guide you through the nuances of sustainable well-being so that you can lead the change that you want to see in the world, and we can truly flourish. Wicked problems. What are they? Well, this was a term that was used in the discipline of social policy planning as early as 1973. It's now widely used to describe complex environmental issues like climate change and social issues, including things like poverty, lack of indigenous land rights, deforestation in the Amazon, illegal oil refineries in Nigeria, corporate greenwashing, and on and on. The characteristics of a wicked problem are the complexity of the problem, the level of uncertainty, and interdependence with many different factors, as well as many social perspectives on the issue of what the problem is and how to tackle it. Generally, wicked problems can also be indeterminate in scope and scale. Think about things like social injustice. Where would you put the boundaries on that? Or something like rising food prices, or climate change, or increased social disparity. There's also no obvious solution when it comes to wicked problems. In fact, there's often no agreement on the problem itself. And sometimes the issue continues to evolve, which makes it increasingly difficult to tackle. And sometimes the timescales are long or uncertain, and it can't be separated from its context. So we can think about the approach to climate change-related sea level rise in New York City versus the approach you would take in the Maldives, this archipelago of low-lying islands. So the approach would be very different, and the problem is very different in each context. So that means this is another wicked problem characteristic. Other characteristics of wicked problems are that they cannot be solved by one actor or necessarily one approach. We can think about ocean plastic pollution. First of all, there are multiple levels of government that can ban certain products. We have a shipping industry whose practices could be mandated or voluntarily changed. We have urban waste that can be dealt with through social campaigns to change behavior. We have a beverage industry that could be mandated or voluntarily change its packaging practices. So clearly, there's not just one actor or one approach. Another characteristic of these wicked problems is just that there's no definitive approach. So we can think about poverty in Cape Town, South Africa versus how you would tackle poverty in Los Angeles in the United States. So very, very different approaches. So those are wicked problem characteristics. In terms of the environmental issues that we face, like climate change and pollution, they're sometimes even called super wicked problems, even bigger than wicked problems. And this was a term also introduced in the social policy planning context back in 2007. And these are where they're wicked problems that have the following four additional characteristics. First of all, there is a significant deadline on finding the solution. Yes, we certainly have a deadline here. And then that there is no central authority dedicated to finding a solution. Third, those seeking to solve the problem are also causing it. Well, that's actually true at all levels, from the individual to governments to corporations. We're all part of the issue. And then finally, there are certain policies that actually irrationally impede the progress towards this end goal. A prime example of that is subsidies for the fossil fuel industry. So yes, we have something called super wicked problems as well that we are working on. How do we approach these wicked or super wicked problems? Well, one of the best ways to tackle a very complex problem like this is to employ something called systems thinking. Systems thinking is defined in Wikipedia as a way of making sense of the complexity of the world by looking at it in terms of wholes and relationships rather than by splitting it down into its parts. It has been used as a way of exploring and developing effective action in complex contexts. End of quote. All right, sounds familiar, right? Complex context is certainly what we have with our wicked problems. And systems thinking has a number of benefits. It allows us to understand the linkages and interactions between elements of the system and allows us to better see the context that we're in and the various perspectives involved. And that can help us to identify the boundaries or the scope of the issue that we want to tackle. And it's useful in better understanding these evolving systems. Systems thinking also supports collaborative and joint action, and it allows us to become more aware of unintended consequences because we've analyzed this complex system more thoroughly. And it allows us to therefore expand the choices that are available to us and then identify those biggest levers to make the change that we want to make. In the end, systems thinking is really a way of creating a new way of seeing and then thinking about a problem. Some of the key components with systems thinking are to consider multiple perspectives, the various worldviews, voices, and knowledge systems that should be brought to bear when analyzing the problem. The other key component to consider are those interconnections, those relationships, the feedback systems, the patterns that we can identify that are there, and really understand those. And then we also want to realize that we should have a clear understanding of what influences different components of the system. What are the levers? Who are the drivers? What's blocking something from happening? And then finally, the next component that we should be considering with systems thinking is to see the boundaries, to be able to define that scope that we're working in. So basically, Systems thinking is big picture thinking. It's about being open to understanding the problem more fully and do so before jumping into a solution. This means maintaining a growth mindset. We all have plenty to learn from expanding our understanding of the issue and thereby find possible solutions that can be more effective than ones we've tried in the past. So, by definition, our wicked problems have no definitive approach. And yet, there may already be solutions out there, right in our own context, or a neighboring one, or an analogous one that we could adopt. These are actually called bright spots. In the book by Chip and Dan Heath, these are two brothers who teach at Stanford and Duke University business schools, respectively, who have written numerous books. But in their book called Switch, they write about bright spots. This is where someone somehow is getting results against the odds on these hard to tackle, really wicked problems. They're not just writing white papers on the complexities of the problem or creating some cumbersome programs with lackluster results. These bright spots are actually showing measurable progress towards key indicators on these complex or wicked problems. And it's all being done in the context of real-world constraints and realities of tight budgets and inertia, lack of public interest or slow regulatory processes, etc. In the Heath Brothers book Switch, they recount a bright spot example where in 1990, a fellow by the name of Jerry Sternum was working for Save the Children, and he was sent to Vietnam to try to deal with childhood malnutrition, which at the time was an enormous problem, especially in rural Vietnam. And Jerry only had 6 months to do this work. He had no real buy-in from the local government. He had very, very limited funds. He didn't even speak Vietnamese. And yet, he was given 6 months to, in quote, make a difference. So this was a really big challenge because, of course, when we looked at the problem of malnutrition in children in the area, it had so many complex issues coming into play. They were things like lack of clean drinking water, poor sanitation, poverty, lack of nutrition education in the population. And he couldn't just spend his time sitting down writing a report about the problem. He needed to really see some change and make a difference. So what Jerry did was he employed a small team of local women and asked them to go out to some local rural villages and measure and weigh all the children in these few villages. And when they came back, they analyzed the data together, and what they were looking for were examples of bright spots of families whose children were really healthy. Based on their height and weight, they were doing really well. And lo and behold, they found just that. They found examples of healthy kids that were doing really well in these impoverished situations. So they knew that solutions existed. Even without addressing the systemic issues at play, they thought maybe some of these hold the solution. Maybe some of these bright spots can be replicated. So what they did is they looked for what was going on in each of the families. But first they had to understand, or Jerry had to understand, the local norms. So they talked about those local norms, and it was normal for families in the area to feed their children twice a day, and these kids would eat with the family and would be able to choose what they wanted to eat and ate all together. And it was normal for the kids when they got sick to not necessarily be actively fed by their parents. And lo and behold, that was one of the differences that they found in these bright spot families, the families with the healthier kids. They were actually feeding their children 4 times a day, but it was the same amount of food. It wasn't just twice a day. They didn't have more food, but they spread it out over 4 meals. When it turns out, malnourished kids have a hard time processing the food that they do get if it's in a larger portion. So it wasn't being absorbed as readily. So spreading it out over 4 meals made a difference. The other thing that these families with healthy kids did was actually actively feed the kids. They helped the children choose the healthiest food from what was in front of them. And they also fed the kids actively when the children were sick, which wasn't the social norm at the time in the area. So this made a big difference. But there was one other interesting difference in the types of food that those families were choosing to feed their kids. They were adding 2 food items to the menu that other families weren't doing. One were sweet potato greens. Now, these greens were largely considered kind of a basic food, maybe something that wasn't really fashionable to feed your children. And yet, we know that these sweet potato greens held so much nutrition, and they were readily available. And so that's what these families were doing. In addition, the mothers were collecting very small shrimps that grew in the rice paddies. And between the protein from these very small shrimps and the vitamins and nutrients coming from the potato greens, the sweet potato greens, they were allowing their children to have access to some missing nutrients that the other kids weren't able to get. And so these were things that were replicable. It didn't just mean that they had a wealthy uncle who worked in the government and sent them money, which isn't something we could replicate. But all of these techniques about feeding multiple portions a day, 4 meals rather than 2, and then actively feeding the children, feeding them when they're sick, and adding these other foods, the sweet potato greens and the small shrimp, were really things that everybody had access to. So rather than Jerry coming in and saying, "Oh, I have the answer. Here, listen to me, do this." No, that wouldn't be the right approach, bringing in someone external to tell you what to do. Rather than do that, what they did is held knowledge translation through cooking schools and clubs where the women in those families who were doing these other practices would get together with other women in the community and, look, share recipes about how to cook nutritious and delicious meals for these kids based on what they had. And they practiced things like washing their hands before meal preparation and talked about feeding their kids while they're sick and so on. And this allowed the transfer of knowledge through a really organic way in the local system. And it really changed the culture of the villages. And it was changed internally with internal knowledge of what was already working there. It was not an imported solution. It was so successful that it went on to be adopted by 14 villages and then spread all over the country through a living university kind of style lab where people from all over the country would come to these villages to learn from the villagers about what they were doing. And once they graduated, they would take the knowledge back to their own villages. In this way, 265 villages were reached, affecting the lives of 2.5 million rural Vietnamese. And this made a measurable, significant reduction of childhood malnutrition. So that's a pretty incredible example of implementing this system of really clear systems thinking, analyzing the situation, and finding a bright spot. Thinking about what you can tackle, where it's working, and where change has been accomplished. Researching the example, having conversations to discover if this is something that can be replicated at a larger scale. So really, wicked problems are complex and difficult to define. And they often cannot be separated from their context. and there's no definitive approach to solving them. There are things like climate change, pollution, loss of biodiversity, plastic pollution in the ocean, environmental racism, social injustices. Those are all examples of wicked problems. But we can approach them by first using systems thinking to better understand the problem and help to illuminate the multiple perspectives, allowing us to see the bigger picture. And then we can achieve measurable results by finding the bright spots that can be replicated in this context and facilitate the domestic spread of these proven approaches. We illuminate wicked environmental and social problems with systems thinking. But examples of success are out there, and these are the bright spots that we must emulate. All right, that's all for today. Let me leave you with a quote from the really incredible Donella Meadows, who wrote the book Thinking in Systems, as well as the Limits to Growth report. And she said, "There is too much bad news to justify complacency, and there is too much good news to justify despair." Thank you, Donella. Well, that's all for now. If you are interested in exploring these issues further, please head on over to my website. It is ChristinaHunterFlourishing.com. That's Christina with a K. Hit the Let's Chat button if you are a professional woman and are deeply concerned about climate change and the state of the world that we are leaving to future generations and want some guidance on the best steps to take. I would love to connect with you. While you are there, sign up for the Flourishing Fridays newsletter. It's your weekly guide to sustainable well-being and effective environmental action. I can't wait to talk to you again. Until then, live well green, my flourishing friends. Bye for now.